enough hex light into the washers to disintegrate all of it. When the extract ended and Pollock opened the machines, there would be nothing but a pile of gray fluff. That would be good. Phyllis had said something, and he hadn't heard.
What? I'm sorry.
I said that Mr. Ordner called. He wants you to call back right away. And a fellow named Harold Swinnerton. He said that cartridges had come in.
Harold? And then he remembered. Harvey's gun shop. Only Harvey, like Marley, was as dead as a doornail.
Yes, right.
He went into his office and closed the door. The sign on his desk still said, "Think. It may be a new experience." He took it off the desk and dropped it into the wastebasket. Clunk. He sat behind his desk, took everything out of the in basket, and threw it into the wastebasket without looking at it. He paused and looked around the office. The walls were wood-paneled. On the left were two framed degrees, one from college, one from the Laundry Institute, where he had gone during the summers of 1969 and 1970. Behind the desk was a large blow-up of himself shaking hands with Ray Tarkington in the Blue Ribbon parking lot, just after it had been hot-topped. He and Ray were smiling. The laundry stood in the background, three trucks backed into the loading bay. The smokestack still looked very white. He had been in this office since 1967, over 6 years. Since before Woodstock, before Kent State, before the assassination of Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King, since before Nixon. Years of his life had been spent between these four walls. Millions of breaths, millions of heartbeats. He looked around, seeing if he felt anything. He felt faintly sad. That was all. He cleaned out his desk, throwing away personal papers and his personal account books. He wrote his resignation on the back of a printed wash formula and slipped it into a laundry pay envelope. He left the impersonal things, the paper clips, the scotch tape, the big book of checks, the pile of blank time cards held together with rubber bands. He got up, took the 2 degrees off the wall, and threw them into the wastebasket. The glass covering the Laundry Institute diploma shattered. The squares where the degrees had hung all these years were a little brighter than the rest of the wall, and that was all. The phone rang, and he picked it up, thinking it would be Ordner. But it was Ron Stone calling from downstairs.
Bart?
Yeah.
Johnny passed away a half hour ago. I guess he never really had a chance.
I'm very sorry. I want to shut it down the rest of the day, Ron. Ron sighed.
That's best, I guess. But won't you catch hell from the big bosses?
I don't work for the big bosses anymore. I just wrote my resignation. There. It was out. That made it real. A dead beat of silence on the other end. He could hear the washers and the steady thumping hiss of the ironer, the mangler, they called it, on account of what would happen to you if you ever got caught in it.
I must have heard you wrong, Ron said finally. I thought you said...
I said it, Ron. I'm through. It's been a pleasure working with you and Tom and even Venny, when he could keep his mouth shut. But it's over.
Hey, listen, Bart, take it easy. I know this has got you upset.
It's not over, Johnny, he said, not knowing if it was true or not. Maybe he still would have made an effort to save himself, to save the life that had existed under a protective dome of routine for the last 20 years. But when the priest had walked quickly past them down the hall, almost running, to the place where Johnny lay dying or dead, and when Arnie Walker had made that funny whining noise high up in his throat, he had given up. Like driving a car in a skid, or fooling yourself that you were driving, and then just taking your hands off the wheel and putting them over your eyes. It's not over, Johnny, he repeated.
Well, listen. Listen.
Ron sounded very upset. Look, I'll talk to you later, Ron, he said, not knowing if he would or not. Go on. Have them punch out.
Okay. Okay, but...
He hung up gently. He took the phone book out of the drawer and looked in the yellow pages under Guns. He dialed Harvey's gun shop.
Hello, Harvey's.
This is Barton Dawes, he said.
All right.
Those shells came in late yesterday afternoon. I told you I'd have them in plenty of time for Christmas. 200 rounds.
Good. Listen, I'm going to be awfully busy this afternoon. Are you open tonight?
Open nights until 9, right up to Christmas.
Okay. I'll try to get in around 8. If not, tomorrow afternoon for sure.
Good enough. Listen, did you find out if it was Boca Rio?
Boca, oh, yes, Boca Rio, where his cousin Nick Adams would soon be hunting.
Boca Rio, yeah, I think it was. Jesus, I envy him. That was the best time I ever had in my life.
Shaky ceasefire holds, he said. A sudden image came to him of Johnny Walker's head mounted over Stefan Ordner's electric log fireplace, with a small, polished bronze plaque beneath, saying, Homo Laundromat, November 28, 1973, bagged on the corner of Diekman.
What was that? Harry Swinnerton asked, puzzled.
I said, I envy him too, he said, and closed his eyes. A wave of nausea raced through him. I'm cracking up, he thought. This is called cracking up.
Oh, well, I'll see you then.
Sure. Thanks again, Mr. Swinnerton. He hung up, opened his eyes, and looked around his denuded office again. He flicked the button on the intercom.
Phyllis?
Yes, Mr. Dawes?
Johnny died. We're going to shut it down.
I saw people leaving and thought he must have.
Phyllis sounded as if she might have been crying.
See if you can get Mr. Ordner on the phone before you go, will you?
Surely.
He swiveled around in his chair and looked out the window. A road grader, bright orange, was lumbering by with chains on its oversized wheels, lashing at the road. This is their fault, Freddy. All their fault. I was doing okay until those guys down at City Hall decided to rip up my life. I was doing fine, right, Freddy? Freddy? Fred? The phone rang, and he picked it up.
Dawes?
You've gone crazy, Steve Ordner said flatly. Right out of your mind.
What do you mean?
I mean that I personally called Mr. Monahan this morning at 9:30. The McCann people signed the papers on the Waterford plant at 9 o'clock. Now what the fuck happened, Barton?
I think we'd better discuss that in person.
So do I. And I think you ought to know that you're going to have to do some fast talking if you want to save your job.
Stop playing games with me, Steve.
What?
You've got no intention of keeping me on, not even as the sweeper. I've written my resignation already. It's sealed up, but I can quote it from memory. I quit. Signed, Barton George Dawes.
But why?
He sounded physically wounded. But he wasn't whining like Arnie Walker. He doubted if Steve Ordner had done any whining since his 11th birthday. Whining was the last resort of lesser men.
2 o'clock,
he asked.
2 is fine.
Goodbye, Steve.
Bart!
He hung up and looked blankly at the wall. After a while, Phyllis poked her head in, looking tired and nervous and bewildered beneath her smart, older person hairdo. Seeing her boss sitting quietly in his denuded office did nothing to improve her state of mind.
Mr. Dawes, should I go? I'd be glad to stay if...
No. Go on, Phyllis. Go home.
She seemed to be struggling to say something else, and he turned around and looked out the window, hoping to spare them both embarrassment.
After a moment, the door snicked closed, very softly.
Downstairs, the boiler whined and died. Motors began to start up in the parking lot. He sat in his empty office, in the empty laundry, until it was time to go and see Ordner. He was saying goodbyes.
Ordner's office was downtown, in one of the new high-rise office buildings that the energy crisis might soon make obsolete. 70 stories high, all glass, inefficient to heat in winter, a horror to cool in summer. Amroco's offices were on the 54th floor. He parked his car in the basement parking lot, took the escalator up to lobby level, went through a revolving door and found the right bank of elevators. He rode up with a black woman who had a large afro. She was wearing a jumper and was holding a steno notebook.
"I like your afro,"
he said abruptly, for no reason.
She looked at him coolly and said nothing. Nothing at all. The reception room of Stephen Ordner's office was furnished with free-form chairs and a red-headed secretary who sat beneath a reproduction of Van Gogh's Sunflowers. There was an oyster-colored shag rug on the floor, indirect lighting, indirect music, piping Mantovani. The redhead smiled at him. She was wearing a black jumper, and her hair was bound with a hank of gold yarn.
"Mr. Dawes?"
"Yes."
"Go right in, please."
He opened the door and went right in. Ordner was writing something at his desk, which was topped with an impressive slab of lucite. Behind him, a huge window gave on a western view of the city. He looked up and put his pen down.
"Hello, Bart," he said quietly.
"Hello."
"Sit down.
Is this going to take that long?" Ordner looked at him fixedly.
"I'd like to slap you," he said. "Do you know that? I'd like to slap you all the way around this office. Not hit you or beat you up, just slap you."
"I know that," he said, and did.
"I don't think you have any idea of what you threw away," Ordner said. "I suppose the McAdam people got to you. I hope they paid you a lot, because I had you personally earmarked for an executive vice presidency in this corporation. That would have paid $35,000 a year to start. I hope they paid you more than that."
"They didn't pay me a cent."
"Is that the truth?"
"Yes."
"Then why, Bart? Why, in the name of God?"
"Why should I tell you, Steve?" He took the chair he was supposed to take, the supplicant's chair, on the other side of the big lucite-topped desk. For a moment, Ordner seemed to be at a loss. He shook his head the way a fighter will when he has been tagged, but not seriously.
"Because you're my employee. How's that for a start?"
"Not good enough."
"What does that mean?"
"Steve, I was Ray Tarkington's employee. He was a real person. You might not have cared for him, but you had to admit he was real. Sometimes when you were talking to him, he broke wind or burped or picked dead skin out of his ear. He had real problems. Sometimes I was one of them. Once, when I made a bad decision about billing a motel out in Crager Plaza, he threw me against a door. You're not like him. The blue ribbon is Tinker Toys to you, Steve. You don't care about me. You care about your own upward mobility, so don't give me that employee shit. Don't pretend you stuck your cock in my mouth and I bit it." If Wardner's face was a facade, there was no crack in it. His features continued to register a modulated distress, no more.
"Do you really believe that?" Wardner asked.
"Yes. You only give a damn about the blue ribbon as it affects your status in the corporation, so let's cut the shit. Here." He slid his resignation across the lucite top of the desk. Ordner gave his head another little shake.
"And what about the people you've hurt, Bart? The little people. Everything else aside, you were in a position of importance."
He seemed to taste the phrase.
"What about the people at the laundry who are going to lose their jobs because there's no new plant to switch to?"
He laughed harshly and said, "You cheap son of a bitch. You're too fucking high to see down, aren't you?" Ordner colored. He said carefully,
"You better explain that, Bart."
"Every single wage earner at the laundry, from Tom Granger on down to Pollock in the washroom, has unemployment insurance. It's theirs. They pay for it. If you're having trouble with that concept, think of it as a business deduction, like a four-drink lunch at Benjamin's." Stung, Ordner said,
"That's welfare money, and you know it."
He reiterated, "You cheap son of a bitch." Ordner's hands came together and formed a double fist. They clenched together like the hands of a child that has been taught to say the Lord's Prayer by his bed.
"You were overstepping yourself, Bart."
"No, I'm not. You called me here. You asked me to explain. What did you want to hear me say? I'm sorry. I screwed up. I'll make restitution. I can't say that. I'm not sorry. I'm not going to make restitution. And if I screwed up, that's between me and Mary, and she'll never even know, not for sure." Are you going to tell me I hurt the corporation? I don't think even you are capable of such a lie. After a corporation gets to a certain size, nothing can hurt it. It gets to be an act of God. When things are good, it makes a huge profit. And when times are bad, it just makes a profit. And when things go to hell, it takes a tax deduction. Now you know that.
Ordner said carefully, "What about your own future? What about Mary's?"
"You don't care about that. It's just a lever you think you might be able to use. Let me ask you something, Steve. Is this going to hurt you? Is it going to cut into your salary, into your yearly dividend, into your retirement fund?"
Ordner shook his head. "Go on home, Bart. You are not yourself."
"Why? Because I'm talking about you and not just about bucks?"
"You're disturbed, Bart."
"You don't know," he said, standing up and planting his fists on the lucite top of Ordner's desk. "You're mad at me, but you don't know why. Someone told you that if a situation like this ever came up, you should be mad, but you don't know why."
Ordner repeated carefully.
"You're disturbed."
"You're damn right I am. What are you?"
"Go home, Bart."
"No. But I'll leave you alone, and that's what you want. Just answer one question. For one second, stop being the corporation man and answer one question for me. Do you care about this? Does any of it mean a damn to you?"
Ordner looked at him for what seemed a long time. The city was spread out behind him like a kingdom of towers, wrapped in grayness and mist. He said, "No."
"All right," he said softly. He looked at Ordner without animosity.
"I didn't do it to screw you, or the corporation."
"Then why? I answered your question. You answer mine. You could have signed on the Waterford plant. After that, it would have been someone else's worry. Why didn't you?"
He said,
"I can't explain. I listened to myself. But people talk a different language inside. It sounds like the worst kind of shit if you try to talk about it, but it was the right thing."
Ordner looked at him unflinchingly.
"And Mary?"
He was silent.
"Go home, Bart," Ordner said.
"What do you want, Steve?"
Ordner shook his head impatiently. "We're done, Bart. If you want to have an encounter session with someone, go to a bar."
"What do you want from me?"
"Only for you to get out of here and go home."
"What do you want from life, then? Where are you hooked into things?"
"Go home, Bart."
"Answer me! What do you want?"
He looked at Ordner nakedly. Ordner answered quietly.
"I want what everyone wants. Go home, Bart."
He left without looking back. And he never went there again. When he got to Magliori's used cars, it was snowing hard, and most of the cars he passed had their headlights on. His windshield wipers beat a steady back-and-forth tune, and beyond their sweep, snow that had been defrosted into slush ran down the safety glass like tears. He parked in back and walked around to the office. Before he went in, he looked at his ghostly reflection in the plate glass and scrubbed a thin pink film from his lips. The encounter with Ordner had upset him more than he would have believed. He had picked up a bottle of Pepto-Bismol in a drugstore and had chugged half of it on the way out there. "Probably won't shit for a week, Fred." But Freddy wasn't at home. Maybe he had gone to visit Monahan's relatives in Bombay. The woman behind the adding machine gave him a strained, speculative smile and waved him in. Magliori was alone. He was reading the Wall Street Journal, and when he came in, Magliori threw it across the desk and into the wastebasket. It landed with a rattling thump.
"It's going right to fucking hell," Magliori said, as if continuing an interior dialogue that had started some time ago. "All these stockbrokers and old women, just like Paul Harvey says. Will the president resign? Will he? Won't he? Will he? Is GE going to go bankrupt with the energy shortage? It gives me a pain in the ass.
Yeah, he said, but not sure of what he was agreeing to. He felt uneasy, and he wasn't totally sure Magliori remembered who he was. What should he say? I'm the guy who called you a dork, remember? Christ, that was no way to start.
Snowing harder, ain't it?
Yes, it is.
I hate the snow. My brother, he goes to Puerto Rico November 1st every year, stays until April 15th. He owns 40% of a hotel there. Says he has to look after his investment. Shit. He wouldn't know how to look after his own ass if you gave him a roll of Charmin. What do you want?
Huh? He jumped a little and felt guilty.
You came to me to get something. How can I get it for you if I don't know what it is?
When it was put with such abrupt baldness, he found it hard to speak. The word for what he wanted seemed to have too many corners to come out of his mouth. He remembered something he had done as a kid and smiled a little.
What's funny? Magliori asked with sharp pleasantness. With business the way it is, I could use a joke.
Once, when I was a kid, I put a yo-yo in my mouth, he said.
That's funny.
No, I couldn't get it out. That's funny. My mother took me to the doctor and he got it out. He pinched my ass, and when I opened my mouth to yell, he just yanked it out.
I ain't gonna pinch your ass, Magliori said. What do you want, Dawes?
Explosives, he said. Magliori looked at him. He rolled his eyes. He started to say something and slapped one of his hanging jowls instead.
Explosives?
Yes.
I knew this guy was a fruiter, Magliori told himself. I told Pete when you left, there goes a guy looking for an accident to happen. That's what I told him.
He said nothing. Talk of accidents made him think of Johnny Walker.
Okay, okay, I'll bite. What do you want explosives for? You going to blow up the Egyptian Trade Exposition? You going to skyjack an airplane? Or maybe just blow your mother-in-law to hell?
I wouldn't waste explosives on her, he said stiffly, and that made them both laugh, but it didn't break the tension.
So, what is it? Who have you got a hard-on against?
He said, I don't have a hard-on against anyone. If I wanted to kill somebody, I'd buy a gun. Then he remembered he had bought a gun, had bought two guns, and his Pepto-Bismol drugged stomach began to roll again.
So why do you need explosives?
I want to blow up a road. Magliori looked at him with measured incredulity. All his emotions seemed larger than life. It was as if he had adopted his character to fit the magnifying properties of his glasses.
You want to blow up a road? What road?
It hasn't been built yet. He was beginning to get a sort of perverse pleasure from this, and of course it was postponing the inevitable confrontation with Mary.
So you want to blow up a road that hasn't been built? I had you wrong, mister. You're not a fruitcake. You're a psycho. Can you make sense?
Picking his words carefully, he said, They're building a road that's known as the 784 extension. When it's done, the state turnpike will go right through the city. For certain reasons I don't want to go into, because I can't, that road has wrecked 20 years of my life. It's
because they're going to knock down the laundry where you work and your house?
How did you know that?
I told you I was going to check you. Did you think I was kidding? I even knew you were going to lose your job, maybe before you did.
No, I knew that a month ago, he said, not thinking about what he was saying.
And how are you going to do it? Were you planning to just drive past the construction, lighting fuses with your cigar, and throwing bundles of dynamite out of your car window?
No. Whenever there's a holiday, they leave all their machines at the site. I want to blow them all up. And all three of the new overpasses, I want to blow them up too. Magliori goggled at him. He goggled for a long time. Then he threw back his head and laughed. His belly shook, and his belt buckle heaved up and down like a chip of wood riding a heavy swell. His laughter was full and hearty and rich. He laughed until tears splurted out of his eyes, and then he produced a huge comic opera handkerchief from some inner pocket and wiped them. He stood watching Magliori laugh and was suddenly very sure that this fat man with the thick glasses was going to sell him the explosives. He watched Magliori with a slight smile on his face. He didn't mind the laughter. Today, laughter sounded good.
"Man, you're crazy, all right," Magliori said when his laughter had subsided to chuckles and hitchings. "I wish Pete could have been here to hear this. He's never going to believe it. Yesterday you called me a dork, and today...
And he was off again, roaring his laughter, mopping his eyes with his handkerchief. When his mirth had subsided again, he asked,
"How are you going to finance this little venture, Mr. Dawes, now that you're no longer gainfully employed?"
That was a funny way to put it. No longer gainfully employed. When you said it that way, it really sounded true. He was out of a job. All of this was not a dream.
"I cashed in my life insurance last month," he said. "I'd been paying on a $10,000 policy for 10 years. I've got about $3,000. "You've really been planning this for that long?"
"No," he said honestly. "When I cashed the policy in, I wasn't sure what I wanted it for."
"In those days, you were still keeping your options open, right? You thought you might burn the road, or machine gun it to death, or strangle it, or..."
"No. I just didn't know what I was going to do. Now I know."
"Well, count me out."
"What?" He blinked at Magliori, honestly stunned. This wasn't in the script. Magliori was supposed to give him a hard time in a fatherly sort of way, then sell him the explosive. Magliori was supposed to offer a disclaimer, something like, "If you get caught, I'll deny I ever heard of you."
"What did you say?" "I said no. N-O. That spells no."
He leaned forward. All the good humor had gone out of his eyes. They were flat and suddenly small in spite of the magnification the glasses caused. They were not the eyes of a jolly Neapolitan Santa Claus at all.
"Listen," he said to Magliori, "if I get caught, I'll deny I ever heard of you. I'll never mention your name." "The fuck you would. You'd spill your fucking guts and cop an insanity plea. I'd go up for life."
"No,
listen. You listen," Magliori said. "You're funny up to a point. That point has been got to. I said no, I meant no. No guns, no explosive, no dynamite, no nothing. Because why? Because you're a fruitcake and I'm a businessman. Somebody told you I could get things. I can get them all right. I've gotten lots of things for lots of people. I've also gotten a few things for myself. In 1946, I got a 2-to-5 bid for carrying a concealed weapon. Did 10 months. In 1952, I got a conspiracy rap, which I beat. In 1955, I got a tax evasion rap, which I also beat. In 1959, I got a receiving stolen property rap, which I didn't beat. I did 18 months in Castleton, but the guy who talked to the grand jury got life in a hole in the ground. Since 1959, I've been up 3 times. Case dismissed twice, rap beat once. They'd like to get me again because one more good one and I'm in for 20 years. No time off for good behavior. A man in my condition, the only part of him that comes out after 20 years is his kidneys, which they give to some Norton nigger in the welfare ward. This is some game to you. Crazy, but a game. It's no game to me. You think you're telling the truth when you say you keep your mouth shut, but you're lying. Not to me, to you. So the answer is flat no." He threw up his hands. "If it had been broads, Jesus, I would have given you 2 free just for that floor show you put on yesterday. But I ain't going for any of this."
"All right," he said. His stomach felt worse than ever. He felt like he was going to throw up.
"This place is clean," Magliori said, "and I know it's clean. Furthermore, I know you're clean, although God knows you're not going to be if you go on like this. But I'll tell you something. About 2 years ago, this nigger came to me and he said he wanted explosives. He wasn't going to blow up something harmless like a road. He was going to blow up a fucking federal courthouse."
"Don't tell me any more," he was thinking. I'm going to puke, I think. His stomach felt full of feathers, all of them tickling at once.
I sold him the goop, Magliari said. Some of this, some of that. We dickered, he talked to his guys, I talked to my guys. Money changed hands. A lot of money. The goop changed hands. They caught the guy and two of his buddies before they could hurt anyone, thank God. But I never lost a minute's sleep worrying, was he going to spill his guts to the cops, or the county prosecutor, or the FBI? You know why? Because he was with a whole bunch of fruitcakes. Nigger fruitcakes, and they're the worst kind. And a bunch of fruitcakes is a different proposition altogether. A single nut like you, he doesn't give a shit. He burns out like a light bulb. But if there are 30 guys, and three of them get caught, they just zip up their lips and put things on the back burner.
All right, he said again. His eyes felt small and hot.
Listen, Magliari said, a little more quietly. $3,000 wouldn't buy you what you want anyway. This is like the black market, you know what I mean? No pun intended. It would take 3 or 4 times that to buy the goop you need.
He said nothing. He couldn't leave until Magliari dismissed him. This was like a nightmare, only it wasn't. He had to keep telling himself that he wouldn't do something stupid in Magliari's presence, like trying to pinch himself awake.
Dawes?
What?
It wouldn't do any good anyway. Don't you know that? You can blow up a person, or you can blow up a natural landmark, or you can destroy a piece of beautiful art, like that crazy shit that took a hammer to the Pietà, Mayor's Dink Rudolph, but you can't blow up buildings or roads or anything like that. It's what all these crazy niggas don't understand. If you blow up a federal courthouse, the feds build 2 to take its place. One to replace the blown-up one, and one just to rack up each and every black ass that gets busted through the front door. If you go around killing cops, they hire 6 cops for every one you killed, and every one of the new cops is on the prowl for dark meat. You can't win, Dawes. White or black. If you get in the way of that road, they'll plow you under, along with your house and your job.
I have to go now, he heard himself say thickly.
Yeah, you look bad. You need to get this out of your system. I can get you an old whore if you wanna. Old and stupid. You can beat the shit out of her if you want to. Get rid of the poison. I sorta like you, and...
He ran. He ran blindly. Out the door and through the main office and out into the snow. He stood there shivering, drawing in great white freezing gulps of the snowy air. He was suddenly sure that Magliari would come out after him, collar him, take him back into the office, and talk to him until the end of time. When Gabriel trumpeted in the apocalypse, Sally One-Eye would still be patiently explaining the invulnerability of all systems everywhere and urging the old whore on him. When he got home, the snow was almost 6 inches deep. The plows had been by, and he had to drive the LTD through a crusted drift of snow to get in the driveway. The LTD made it no sweat. It was a good, heavy car. The house was dark. When he opened the door and stepped in, stamping snow off on the mat, it was also silent. Merv Griffin was not chatting with the celebrities.
Mary? He called.
There was no answer.
Mary!
He was willing to think she wasn't home until he heard her crying in the living room. He took off his topcoat and hung it on its hanger in the closet. There was a small box on the floor under the hanger. The box was empty. Mary put it there every winter to catch drips. He had sometimes wondered, who cares about drips in a closet? Now the answer came to him, perfect in its simplicity. Mary cared. That's who. He went into the living room. She was sitting on the couch in front of the blank Zenith TV, crying. She wasn't using a handkerchief. Her hands were at her sides. She had always been a private weeper, going into the upstairs bedroom to do it, or if it surprised her, hiding her face in her hands or a handkerchief. Seeing her this way made her face seem naked and obscene, the face of a plane crash victim. It twisted his heart. Mary... he said softly. She went on crying, not looking at him. He sat down beside her. "Mary," he said, It's not as bad as that. Nothing is. But, he wondered.
It's the end of everything, she said.
And the words came out splintered by her crying. Oddly, the beauty she had not achieved for good or lost for good was in her face now, shining. In this moment of the final smash, she was a lovely woman. Who told you?
Everybody told me, she cried.
She still wouldn't look at him, but one hand came up and made a twisting, beating movement against the air before falling against the leg of her slacks.
Tom Granger called. Then Ron Stone's wife called. Then Vincent Mason called. They wanted to know what was wrong with you. And I didn't know. I didn't know anything was wrong.
Mary, he said, and tried to take her hand. She snatched it away, as if he might be catching.
Are you punishing me?
She asked, and finally looked at him.
Is that what you're doing? Punishing me?
No, he said urgently. Oh, Mary, no. He wanted to cry now, but that would be wrong. That would be very wrong.
Because I gave you a dead baby? And then a baby with a built-in self-destruct? Do you think I murdered your son? Is that why?
Mary, he was our son.
He was yours!
She screamed at him. Don't, Mary, don't. He tried to hold her, and she fought away from him.
Don't you touch me!
They looked at each other, stunned, as if they had discovered for the first time that there was more to them than they had ever dreamed of. Vast white spaces on some interior map. Mary, I can't help what I did. Please believe that. But it could have been a lie. Nonetheless, he plunged on. If it had something to do with Charlie, it did. I've done some things I don't understand. I cashed in my life insurance policy in October. That was the first thing, the first real thing. But things had been happening in my mind long before that. But it was easier to do things than to talk about them. Can you understand that? Can you try?
What's going to happen to me, Barton? I don't know anything but being your wife. What's going to happen to me?
I don't know.
It's like you raped me,
she said, and began to cry again. Mary, please don't do that anymore. Don't. Try not to do that anymore.
When you were doing all those things, didn't you ever think of me? Didn't you ever think that I depend on you?
He couldn't answer. In a strange, disconnected way, it was like talking to Magliori again. It was as if Magliori had beaten him home and put on a girdle and Mary's clothes and a Mary mask. What next? The offer of the old whore? She stood.
I'm going upstairs. I'm going to lie down.
Mary. She did not cut him off, but he discovered there were no words to follow that first. She left the room, and he heard her footsteps going upstairs. After that, he heard the creak of her bed as she lay down on it. After that, he heard her crying again. He got up and turned on the TV and jacked the volume so he wouldn't be able to hear it. On the TV, Merv Griffin was chatting with celebrities. Part 2. December. Ah, love, let us be true to one another, for the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused armies of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. Matthew Arnold, Dover Beach. December 5, 1973. He was drinking his private drink, Southern Comfort and 7-Up, and watching some TV program he didn't know the name of. The hero of the program was either a plainclothes cop or a private detective, and some guy had hit him over the head. This had made the plainclothes cop, or private detective, decide that he was getting close to something. Before he had a chance to say what, there was a commercial for Gravy Train. The man in the commercial was saying that Gravy Train, when mixed with warm water, made its own gravy. He asked the audience if it didn't look just like beef stew.
To Barton George Dawes, it looked just like a loose bowel movement that somebody had done in a red dog dish.
The program came back on. The private eye, or plainclothes police detective, was questioning a black bartender who had a police record. The bartender said, dig. The bartender said, flake off. The bartender said, dude. He was a very hip bartender, all right. But Barton George Dawes thought that the private cop, or plainclothes investigator, had his number. He was quite drunk, and he was watching television in his shorts and nothing else. The house was hot. He had turned the thermostat to 78 degrees and had left it there ever since Mary left. What energy crisis. Fuck you, Dick. Also the horse you rode in on. Fuck Checkers, too. When he got on the turnpike, he drove at 70, giving the finger to motorists who honked at him to slow down. The president's consumer expert, some woman who looked as if she might have been a child star in the 1930s before passing time had turned her into a political hermaphrodite, had been on a public service program two nights ago talking about the ways you and I could save electricity around the house. Her name was Virginia Nauer, and she was very big on different ways you and I could save energy, because this thing was a real bitch and we were all in it together. When the program was over, he had gone into the kitchen and turned on the electric blender. Mrs. Nauer had said that blenders were the second biggest small appliance energy wasters. He had let the blender run on all night, and when he got up the next morning, yesterday morning, the motor had burned out. The greatest electricity waster, Mrs. Nauer had said, were those little electric space heaters. He didn't have an electric space heater, but he had toyed with the idea of getting one so he could run it day and night until it burned up. Possibly, if he was drunk and passed out, it would burn him up too. That would be the end of the whole silly, self-pitying mess. He poured himself another drink and fell to musing over the old TV programs, the ones they had been running when he and Mary were still practically newlyweds, and a brand new RCA console model TV, your ordinary garden variety RCA console model black and white TV, was something to boggle over. There had been the Jack Benny program, and Amos and Andy, those original jive-ass niggers. There was Dragnet, the original Dragnet, with Ben Alexander for Joe Friday's partner instead of that new guy, Harry somebody. There had been Highway Patrol with Broderick Crawford growling 10-4 into his mic, and everybody driving around in Buicks that still had portholes on the side. Your Show of Shows, your Hit Parade, with Giselle McKenzie singing things like Green Door and Stranger in Paradise. Rock and Roll had killed that one. Or how about the quiz shows? How about them? Tic-Tac-Doe and 21 every Monday night, starring Jack Barry. People going into isolation booths and putting UN-style earphones on their heads to hear fucking incredible questions they had already been briefed on. The $64,000 question with Hal March. Contestants staggering off stage with their arms full of reference books. Dotto with Jack Nars, and Saturday morning programs like Annie Oakley, who was always saving her kid brother Tag from some Christless mess. He had always wondered if that kid was really her bastard. There was Rin Tin Tin, who operated out of Fort Apache. Sergeant Preston, who operated out of the Yukon, sort of a roving assignment, you might say. Range Rider with Jock Mahoney. Wild Bill Hickok with Guy Madison and Andy Devine as Jingles. Mary would say, Bart, if people knew you watched all that stuff, they'd think you were feeble. Honestly, a man your age. And he had always replied, I want to be able to talk to my kids, kid. Except there had never been any kids, not really. The first one had been nothing but a dead mess. What was that old joke about putting wheels on miscarriages? And the second had been Charlie, who it was best not to think of. I'll be seeing you in my dreams, Charlie. Every night, it seemed he and his son got together in one dream or another. Barton George Dawes and Charles Frederick Dawes, reunited by the wonders of the subconscious mind. And here we are, folks, back in Disney World's newest head trip, Self-Pity Land, where you can take a gondola ride down the Canal of Tears, visit the Museum of Old Snapshots, and go for a ride in the wonderful Nostalgia-mobile, driven by Fred McMurray. The last stop on your tour is this wonderful replica of Crest Allen Street West. It's right here inside this giant Southwark Comfort bottle, preserved for all time. That's right, madam. Just duck your head as you walk into the neck. It'll widen out soon. And this is the home of Barton George Dawes, the last living resident of Crest Allen Street West. Look right in the window here. Just a second, Sonny. I'll boost you up. That's George, all right, sitting in front of his Zenith color TV in his stupid boxer shorts, having a drink and crying. Crying? Of course he's crying. What else would he be doing in Self-Pity Land? He cries all the time. The flow of his tears is regulated by our world-famous team of engineers. On Mondays, he just mists a little, because that's a slow night. The rest of the week, he cries a lot more. On the weekend, he goes into overdrive. And on Christmas, we may float him right away. I admit, he's a little disgusting, but nonetheless, he's one of Self-Pity Land's most popular inhabitants, right up there with our recreation of King Kong atop the Empire State Building. He threw his drink at the television. He missed by quite a bit. The glass hit the wall, fell to the floor, and shattered. He burst into fresh tears. Crying, he thought. Look at me. Look at me. Jesus, you're disgusting. You're such a fucking mess. It's beyond belief. You spoiled your whole life and Mary's, too, and you sit here joking about it, you fucking waste. Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. He was halfway to the telephone before he could stop himself. The night before, drunk and crying, he had called Mary and begged her to come back. He had begged until she began to cry and hung up on him. It made him squirm and grin to think of it, that he had done such a god-awful, embarrassing thing. He went on to the kitchen, got the dustpan and the whisk broom, and went back to the living room. He shut off the TV and swept up the glass. He took it into the kitchen, weaving slightly, and dumped it into the trash. Then he stood there, wondering what to do next. He could hear the insectile buzz of the refrigerator, and it frightened him. He went to bed and dreamed. December 6, 1973. It was 3:30, and he was slamming up the turnpike toward home, doing 70. The day was clear and hard and bright, the temperature in the low 30s. Every day since Mary had left, he went for a long ride on the turnpike. In a way, it had become his surrogate work. It soothed him. When the road was unrolling in front of him, its edges clearly marked by the low early winter snowbanks on either side, he was without thought and at peace. Sometimes he sang along with the radio in a lusty, bellowing voice. Often on these trips, he thought he should just keep going. Letting way lead on to way, getting gas on the credit card, he would drive south and not stop until he ran out of roads or out of land. Could you drive all the way to the tip of South America? He didn't know. But he always came back. He would get off the turnpike, eat hamburgers and french fries in some pickup restaurant, and then drive into the city, arriving at sunset or just past. He always drove down Stanton Street, parked and got out to look at whatever progress the 784 extension had made during the day. The construction company had mounted a special platform for rubberneckers, mostly old men and shoppers with an extra minute. And during the day it was always full. They lined up along the railing like clay ducks in a shooting gallery, the cold vapor pluming from their mouths, gawking at the bulldozers and graders and the surveyors with their sextants and tripods. He could cheerfully have shot all of them. But at night, with the temperatures down in the 20s, with sunset a bitter orange line in the west and thousands of stars already pricking coldly through the firmament overhead, he could measure the road's progress alone and undisturbed. The moments he spent there were becoming very important to him. He suspected that, in an obscure way, the moments spent on the observation platform were recharging him, keeping him tied to a world of at least half sanity. In those moments before the evening's long plunge into drunkenness had begun, before the inevitable urge to call Mary struck, before he began the evening's activities in self-pity land, he was totally himself, coldly and blinkingly sober. He would curl his hands over the iron pipe and stare down at the construction until his fingers became as unfeeling as the iron itself, and it became impossible to tell where the world of himself, the world of human things, ended, and the outside world of tractors and cranes and observation platforms began. In those moments there was no need to blubber or pick over the rick-rack of the past that jumbled his memory. In those moments he felt his self pulsing warmly in the cold indifference of the early winter evening, a real person, perhaps still whole. Now, whipping up the turnpike at 70, still 40 miles away from the Westgate toll booths, he saw a figure standing in the breakdown lane just past exit 16, muffled up in a CPO coat and wearing a black knitted watch cap. The figure was holding up a sign that said, amazingly, in all this snow, Las Vegas. And underneath that, defiantly, or bust. He slammed on the power brake and felt the seatbelt strain a groove in his middle with a swift deceleration, a little exhilarated by the Richard Petty sound of his own squealing tires. He pulled over about 20 yards beyond the figure. It tucked its sign under its arm and ran toward him. Something about the way the figure was running told him the hitchhiker was a girl. The passenger door opened and she got in.
"Hey, thanks."
"Sure." He glanced in the rearview mirror and pulled out, accelerating back to 70. The road unrolled in front of him again.
"A long way to Vegas."
"It sure is."
She smiled at him, the stock smile for people that told her it was a long way to Vegas, and pulled off her gloves.
"Do you mind if I smoke?"
"No, go ahead."
She pulled out a box of Marlboros.
"Like one?"
"No, thanks."
She stuck a cigarette in her mouth, took a box of kitchen matches from her CPO pocket, lit her smoke, took a huge drag, and chuffed it out, fogging part of the windshield. Put Marlboros and matches away, loosened the dark blue scarf around her neck, and said,
"I appreciate the ride. It's cold out there."
"Were you waiting long?"
"About an hour. The last guy was drunk. Man, I was glad to get out."
He nodded.
"I'll take you to the end of the turnpike."
"End?"
She looked at him.
"You're going all the way to Chicago?"
"What?"
"Oh, no." He named his city.
"But the turnpike goes through there."
She pulled a Sunoco road map, dog-eared from much thumbing, from her other coat pocket.
"The map says so."
"Unfold it and look again."
She did so.
"What color is the part of the turnpike we're on now?"
"Green."
"What color is the part going through the city?"
"Dotted green. It's..." "Oh, Christ. It's under construction."
"That's right. The world-famous 784 extension. Girl, you'll never get to Las Vegas if you don't read the key to your map."
She bent over it, her nose almost touching the paper. Her skin was clear, perhaps normally milky, but now the cold had brought a bloom to her cheeks and forehead. The tip of her nose was red, and a small drop of water hung beside her left nostril. Her hair was clipped short and not very well. A home job. A pretty chestnut color. Too bad to cut it. Worse to cut it badly. What was that Christmas story by O. Henry? The Gift of the Magi. Who did you buy a watch chain for, little wanderer?
"The solid green picks up at a place called Landy," she said. "How far is that from where this part ends?"
"About 30 miles.
"Oh, Christ."
She puzzled over the map some more. Exit 15 flashed by.
"What's the bypass road?"
she asked finally.
"It just looks like a snarl to me."
"Route 7's best," he said. "It's at the last exit, the one they call Westgate."
He hesitated.
"But you'd do better to just hang it up for the night. There's a Holiday Inn. You won't get there until almost dark, and you don't want to try hitching up Route 7 after dark."
Why not? She asked, looking over at him. Her eyes were green and disconcerting, an eye color you read about occasionally but rarely see. It's a city bypass road, he said, taking charge of the passing lane and roaring past a whole line of vehicles doing 50. Several of them honked at him angrily. Four lanes with a little bitty concrete divider between them. Two lanes west toward Landy, two lanes east into the city. Lots of shopping centers and hamburger stands and bowling alleys and all that. Everybody is going in short hops. No one wants to stop.
Yeah, she sighed. Is there a bus to Landy?
There used to be a city bus, but it went bankrupt. I guess there must be a Greyhound.
Oh, fuck it.
She squidged the map back together and stuffed it into her pocket. She stared at the road, looking put out and worried. Can't afford a motel room?
Mister, I've got 13 bucks. I couldn't rent a doghouse.
You can stay at my house if you want, he said.
Yeah, and maybe you better let me out right here.
Never mind. I withdraw the offer.
Besides, what would your wife think?
She looked pointedly at the wedding ring on his finger. It was a look that suggested she thought he might also hang around school play yards after the monitor had gone home for the day. My wife and I are separated.
Recently?
Yes, as of December 1st.
And now you've got all these hang-ups that you could use some help with, she said.
There was contempt in her voice, but it was an old contempt, not aimed specifically at him.
Especially some help from a young chick.
I don't want to lay anybody, he said truthfully. I don't even think I could get it up. He realized he had just used two terms that he had never used before a woman in his life. But it seemed all right. Not good or bad, but all right, like discussing the weather.
Is that supposed to be a challenge? She asked.
She drew deeply on her cigarette and exhaled more smoke. No, he said. I suppose it sounds like a line if you're looking for lines. I suppose a girl on her own has to be looking for them all the time.
This must be part 3, she said.
There was still mild contempt and hostility in her tone, but now it was cut with a certain tired amusement.
How did a nice girl like you get in a car like this?
Ah, to hell with it, he said. You're impossible.
That's right. I am.
She snuffed her cigarette in his ashtray and then wrinkled her nose.
Look at this. Full of candy wrappers and cellophane and every other kind of shit. Why don't you get a litter bag?
Because I don't smoke. If you had just called ahead and said, Barton, old boy, I intend to be hitching the turnpike today, so give me a ride, would you? And by the way, clear the shit out of your ashtray because I intend to smoke, then I would have emptied it. Why don't you just throw it out the window? She was smiling.
You have a nice sense of irony.
It's my sad life.
Do you know how long it takes filter tips to biodegrade? 200 years, that's how long. By that time, your grandchildren will be dead.
He shrugged. You don't mind me breathing in your used carcinogens, screwing up the cilia in my lungs, but you don't want to throw a filter tip out into the turnpike. Okay.
What's that supposed to mean?
Nothing.
Listen, do you want to let me out? Is that it?
No, he said. Why don't we just talk about something neutral? The state of the dollar. The state of the union. The state of Arkansas.
I think I'd rather catch a little nap, if you don't mind. It looks like I'm going to be up most of the night.
Fine. She tilted the watch cap over her eyes, folded her arms, and became still. After a few moments, her breathing deepened to long strokes. He looked at her in short snatches, shoplifting an image of her. She was wearing blue jeans, tight, faded, thin. They molded her legs closely enough to let him know that she wasn't wearing a second pair or long handles. They were long legs, folded under the dashboard for comfort, and they were probably blushing lobster red now, itching like hell. He started to ask her if her legs itched and then thought how it would sound. The thought of her hitchhiking all night on Route 7, either getting rides in short hops or not getting rides at all, made him feel uncomfortable. Night, thin pants, temperatures in the 20s. Well, it was her business. If she got cold enough, she could go in someplace and warm up. No problem. They passed exits 14 and 13. He stopped looking at her and concentrated on his driving. The speedometer needle stayed pegged at 70, and he stayed in the passing lane. More cars honked at